Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens.
Right here on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome along. You are with Media Matters here with Marie on Reality Check Radio, and joining me now, my partner in crime, my own very Slim Shady, who's actually been out and about painting up storm, Marty Gibson. You're painting your house, mate.
Yeah, painting the house. Got one of those hardy board houses, so you need to keep painting it, otherwise it can crack and lead and water, and we don't want that.
No. So how's that going? What sort of, I mean, you're in there, that your lovely little community there in Papamoa. Are you going sort of gentle tranquility beach tones, or are we going funky dunky bride? What are we doing?
Well, my kids say that I'm painting it like a Minecraft house. It's kind of, I wanted to paint it so the walls were the same color as the aluminium joinery. Where the house goes in, going to paint it some brighter colors so it looks like, you know, someone's taken a bite out of it and it's quite brightly coloured inside a grey exterior. But a lot of what I do here is fighting back against the urban sameness of Papamoa. You know, we've all got the same fences and it's like being a rat in a maze. So it's just sort of with that. Like, so it was sort of a sandy beige and, yeah, now it's going to be a little bit freaky-deakier.
Well, with those lovely freaky deaky colours, if you get any neighbours that give you the side eye, you can always say, oh, no, this is my wife's bright Indian sensibilities. And you've got fine weather for the painting, and of course it's hot and fine. And when it's hot and fine and warm, which it is where I am in the bay, 33 yesterday, it was very warm, sometimes the crazies come out. This week in the paper, I have to admit, it was you and I both struggled to find really anything of substance. Mm. There was lots of high grist, high volume, I get the sense that those within the legacy space, I mean, they're not talking about the COVID inquiry. Where's the fun in that, other than the odd opinion piece here and there? I mean, let's not talk about our failures, people, particularly when we're complicit in that, which they were. So there was lots of really of nothingness, and the only thing that they would grab hold of any excitement, was the Labour Party conference, which was held over the weekend. Well, that was a little bit, from what I could see, like sitting in a white room watching a man paint a white wall. White.
They're bringing back the Mahuta.
They are bringing back the Mahuta. I mean, that tells you that how desperate they are. But they were also just, you know, talking about how they're going to revolutionise their tax policy. What more can they do to their tax policy, Marty? Really?
Well, I mean, they could start talking about how they're planning to spend the money they do confiscate more effectively, but there's none of that. It's just sort of seen as a bottomless well, isn't it? Or, you know, you can sort of just borrow. And no, it's quite incredible. Reading the media is a little bit like, it sort of occurred to me, it's a little bit like the conversation a serial killer makes when you're on a car ride with them and the built-up area turns to countryside, then the woods. You know, it's sort of, you can't help but feel you're getting a bit distracted, especially, as you say, in the stuff around COVID. And, you know, there's the usual no-show without punch. You know, I looked on the Radio New Zealand website this morning and it's an article by Michael Baker, the Woody Allen of New Zealand, grooming away.
Yeah.
Amanda Kvalsvig and a couple of other people. And his opinion, surprise, surprise, is that there's a rising threat of epidemics and pandemics, which adds urgency for the government to act on the recommendations of the long-awaited inquiry into New Zealand's COVID response. And what they say is we shouldn't cut health spending. Not that anyone's cutting it, but, you know, they're talking about cutting 1,500 more jobs. These capabilities are critical for any future pandemic response. So there is a strong argument to halt the cuts while New Zealanders implementing the recommendations of the COVID inquiry. Again, just there's no public spending that's bad public spending for these folks.
And they've also got, you were talking about the health spending. So there was the news in a couple of weeks ago how a lot of these graduates, the graduate nurses that are coming through now, There's no jobs for them. Well, no jobs for them within a DHB setting, because there's been some ring fences that have gone up, right? There are jobs, though, for these nurses in aged care. But these nurses don't want to go, but they don't want to go into aged care. They feel that they're going to be better served in the DHB. And it's that whole ideology of affluence thing coming in again, that they think that they can pick and choose if and where it is that they go. But now that a little bit of hardship is coming up, they're actually faced with a stark reality that sometimes you've got to eat the shit sandwich you've been dealt with. In that frontline health sector, there is a lot of bureaucracy. And a couple of the other themes that sort of cropped up was in terms of Preble. Did you read Preble yesterday? Yeah, and he talked about in terms of the Ministry of Regulation, it's kind of like, well, okay, David, you're there. What are you going to do with it? Now, he didn't touch on health, but both you and I know if there's anywhere in this country that the Ministry of Regulation should be casting a very firm eye over, and that is our healthcare sector. There is red tape up the wazoo, and managers upon managers who manage the other managers, a lot of that can get whipped out to actually make health services more efficient. You've seen it, I've seen it, we know what it can be like. Michael Kingston, that I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, talked to it very eloquently in terms of you need to have more of a direct approach between decision-making, management and patients and the people doing the caring, instead of lots of shiny-bummed laptop lifestyles. Yeah.
You could start by doing some trials, you know, putting medically trained people in charge of hospitals again.
There's a radical idea.
See how you go with that.
Actually, let's frame this today. Let's frame this, because we're going to try and be positive and not as ranty as we're going to put our rants in a more positive framework as opposed to the rants we've
had
the
last couple of weeks.
Oh, well, no, let's do this. And we're going to make Mike from Foxton very happy right now. You ready? Okay, I'm going to throw this at you because we haven't discussed this. Let's do it. If this were the Māori Party, my policy for will be. So if this were the Māori Party, one of my policies for health will be qualified health professionals. But then in saying that, it could bite us in the bum, because theoretically that was Ashley Bloomfield, but every now and then you can get a lemon, I suppose. But putting health professionals in charge.
Oh, a medical superintendent. Right? I mean, there was a wonderful interview that you did with
Michael Kingston, Professor Michael Kingston.
I thought that his what he was saying had a lot of merit.
It did. And he talked about something that was so simple and straightforward that you would think it would be a no-brainer. That's where bureaucracy, it's like a mold, it's like a cancer. It sort of grows and creeps often very slowly to begin with. And then all of a sudden it's gone beyond the point of no return. We need to bring it back.
It's got its own blood supply.
Yeah,
and I mean, I've always been interested in the concept of social bonds. You could take a family that's struggling, and if they had someone mentoring them, I think, you know, you could sort of say eight functional families could help out one less functional family, and the amount of money you could save the health system. Just, you know, get your teeth sorted, turn up for your appointments.
Turning up for appointments. People do not realise how many DNAs there are in the public system.
It's incredible, yeah.
Massive.
And I mean, you can talk to GPs and they often feel quite miffed about the charge that they don't care about Māori and that their health outcomes are because of racism. I've had one in particular say to me, if I had a Māori patient that showed up having some heart issues, I'd be far more proactive with them because I know they don't do well with it. But yeah, the thing they're up against is the DNAs not turning up. And that probably, the thing that goes untapped and also undiscussed is that latent energy that's within the populace, the power we have, and we spoke about this last week, to affect our own outcomes. Politicians and bureaucrats want to be useful. So there's that culture of telling disadvantaged people, in inverted commas, that everything bad that happens to them is someone else's fault. I've said before, we've got to lose our fear of inequality, because if you're trying something different and it works, you want inequality as a sign that it's working.
Well, the natural order of the world is there are winners and losers. And I know that having a utopian ideal where there are no losers is something that I think people would love to see. But the reality of it is the world doesn't work that way. Nature doesn't work that way. So how do you mitigate what a loss looks like? And so for people, when we say we forget because we're used to medical jargon, DNA stands for did not attend. One of the things around socialized medicine and anything that we have as taxpayers, but in a society where you do get so much support from the government, is we've actually got to remember that that's a privilege, not a right.
If you have a business, you quickly learn. You say if you offer some service for a prize or good, anything you offer for free turns into a ball ache for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think free healthcare is no different. People just don't value it. And as a consequence, they don't feel a sense of responsibility for their own health. And that's been terribly counterproductive for some populations.
Incredibly. That cropped up too, actually, because I wrote that privilege and a right thing down. Would you, I mean, I know this is going to seem a bit askance, but Liam Dan, and Liam was talking about free trade and the tariffs, and his headline was RBNZ's grim warning. No more economic booms as productivity woes come to a head. So it's kind of like Liam actually all of a sudden has suddenly realised that monetary theory may not be working. Monetary theory may not be working.
Oh, he's not going to say that.
No, he's not, but there was an inkling there. And he was talking...
There's a shadow of a doubt.
So, of course, you know, we've had the drop in the OCR by 50 basis points last week. Donald Trump proposed tariffs threatened to end the era of free trade and globalization that has underpinned the country's economic success for three decades. The economy is in a precarious position. Now, this is a really interesting thing with the tariffs, right? And I wrote next to this two things. I wrote BRICS and free trade privilege not right. And that is one of the powers that I think Donald Trump can wield. And I think he's going to do it because he's already spoken to these BRICS countries. He's put out a post or sent a shot across the bow, essentially saying that if you do create your own currency to rival the American as the reserve currency, we will apply 100% tariffs against you, which is a really canny thing to do because, of course, the C in BRICS is China, and he's been wanting to – the BRICS countries, in case those were wondering, so you've got Brazil, Russia, I think India, China, Saudi Arabia, and there's a whole heap of others that have now joined them. The UAE is also in there and a whole bunch of other little rats and mice African countries. But it's an interesting thing to sort of do. It's saying to them, look, yep, interesting idea. You've got an interesting idea there, but no, we're not going to tolerate it. And those tariffs... That's one of the things I think we shouldn't be scared of those tariffs. He's going to, I think, by the use of the economy and the manipulation of the economy, he's going to settle down a lot of things. He's going to calm the farm. Because of the free trade and globalization, you've got lots of bad ideas that have been able to promulgate away in one little corner or another little corner and fester away, but it's okay because we can still trade and we're still making a bit of money, so we'll let those fester. Whereas he's saying, no, I'm going to stop those festering wounds by applying tariffs. All of a sudden, things will settle down.
Well, it's absurd that there's so much criticism of, well, nationalism. People elect a government to look after a nation. And populism, they elect people on the basis of what, and, you know, there's the accusation of dog whistle politics and so on. But the question is, well, if politicians aren't acting in a national interest, whose interest are they acting in? And there's that airy greater good thing, you know, that you get. So you've had idiots like James Shaw going around begging for New Zealand to be allowed to include our agriculture in our emissions because we've got to be leaders. These profoundly anti-human policies. It's going to be so interesting to see the effect of Trump, Malay, because he's going to make Christopher Luxon look even more insipid, even more whiffly, even more limp-wristed than he already does. And that's been a tough thing. I mean, I've spent a lot of time on Twitter lately. People are just losing their minds about Christopher Luxon on the left. And I noticed there's not a lot of defense of him on the right. He's in some ways a tough guy to defend, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So with your foreign policy hat on, Marty, of the Marty Party. Hello, it's Marie here from RCR. Got a question for Marty from the Marty Party. his announcement that if Benjamin Netanyahu would want to come to New Zealand, that he would be arrested. Twofold. Why would he even think that Benjamin Netanyahu would want to sanctuary down here? Like, ugh.
Won't know.
Yeah, you certainly won't know. But Pete, why bother saying that? And then he backs it up with, oh, yes, well, this is what the international courts have sort of decreed and we're sort of going to go along that. If you talk to Matt Robson, no one listens to them. Everybody ignores them, especially the United States.
It was bizarre, right? He's not really a politician. He's a corporate drone. And the thing about corporate drones is that they, you know, want to be good boys. And, well, our company policy is this.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's what he's done. Rather than, you know, seeing that it's a bear trap and thinking maybe I shouldn't put my foot in that one.
So next year we're going to create the David Brent moment of the week.
Right.
Okay.
And it's we also need. Off, actually.
It is. We have to own that too, because you heard it here first.
Yeah. Simon Wilson has done it. I think Matthew Hooton's done it. I think that was something that Cam Slater was always very fond of. I actually did troll Christopher Luxon last week and suggested, I don't know how many people have seen the David Brent movie, but there's a song called Equality Street on it. And I wrote to Christopher Luxon and suggested maybe they could use that as their theme song.
Yeah, you're right, though. I think we need to do that for next year. That'll be fun. The David Brent moment of the week for Christopher Luxon. For me, that was his David Brent moment of the week. He's being, in a way, and I don't know whether this is deliberate or not, I don't know whether he's allowing his two coalition cohorts to sort of take the lead on and the heat on a lot of those things. So, I mean, you've had Seymour with his treaty bill, you've had Winston, well, being Winston. Surely, I mean, Seymour's already seeing this as a way to steal soft votes. We talked about that the other day. I can't see how he will sort of move into a second term. And if he does, what basis?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a business as usual, divisive corporate drone prime minister when we need a uniting, reforming, visionary one. And as I said, you know, with the world suddenly accelerating in terms of the pace of change and the tide going out on that cancel culture way of thinking, and the National Party put in place basically what they saw was a National Party equivalent of Jacinda and thought, well, what we'll do is we'll do Labour because that, you know, seems to be popular, but we'll just sort of dress it up as a bit more financially prudent. There's a big chasm opening up in the terms of the way people see the world, and that's the frustrating thing about consuming media at the moment, isn't it? And that there are those who are comfortable thinking that those in charge are kind of stupid. They make dumb mistakes that always seem to erode freedom and health while concentrating power in various unelected technocracies. And then there are people who, like most RCR listeners and me and you, think there's some malevolence and a bit of a plan to do those things, and it's not just accidental. And so that's the key difference between RCR, I would say, and the legacy media. And you have to say, just on the basis of listenership at the moment, if you look at what's happening in the States, where Joe Rogan's 10 times more, got a listenership that's 10 times bigger than all the cable news networks put together, with Tucker Carlson, you know, working out of his basement in Maine, is absolutely caning cable news. New Zealand will follow that.
I listened to James Lindsay talk to the Trigonometry Boys. He was talking about the end of wokeness, and he said, no, wokeness is over as a concept. It's over. The people are done with it. The problem is, of course, is that the blob of government isn't done with it yet. They quite like it. It's good for their jobs. They really
do quite handy for them.
Yeah, it is. It's been very handy for them. Those identity groups that have done very, very well out of it. So the rainbow communities, the indigenous groups, anybody that can tack an identity onto something can claim a marginalised status. You know, they want to cling on to it because all of a sudden they've done very well out of it, generally, fiscally, as well as socially. And then you have the media and academia. And so the boys did ask him, you know, will it change? Will it completely reform? And he said, it will reform in all areas, with the exception of potentially academia, which perpetrated it. I mean, American academia brought wokeness to the world, and then the media promulgated it. So unless the media start playing a little bit of atonement for the things that they have done, then you're not going to see that happen. And I've been waiting and watching to see whether that atonement will start happening after what has just transpired this week, which of course is Joe Biden pardoning Hunter. But not only pardoning him, but creating a pardon and immunity that goes back to a certain date in 2014, which by inference also absolves him of any wrongdoing. Mm. So he's done his final little middle finger to Nancy Pelosi.
Well, avoid disclosure in a court process, which wouldn't be kind to him with the Burisma. Let's not forget, a million people are dead from that.
Mm-hmm. But the media, when he, in the middle of this year, when he said, no, I would not be pardoning my son, and they were literally creaming themselves on television over it. And, oh, this is unlike Donald Trump. We have a president that withstands and understands the rule of law. Mm. Where are they now? Crickets.
Well, now they're saying, well, you know, the Republicans have signaled that they're going to be coming after us with lawfare, and it was only a gun charge that normally wouldn't be prosecuted. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and normies, everyday people, I mean, if there are any still watching CNN and MSNBC, they must be sitting there going, what the? And yeah, they're turning away.
I saw one commentator, I can't remember his name, was saying, you know, if you had have said, hey, look, my only son, I've got the power to pardon him. I'm an old man. I'm going to use it. People could have gone, well, okay. But to dress it up in this moralizing, I think has, you know, as you say, given people a bit of pause for thought. And I mean, again, I don't get how Biden was in any way electable. He just gives me the creeps. Everything about him gives me the creeps in terms of the way he talks and his tough guy act and how it turned out.
Mm-hmm. His propensity for hair snipping.
Yeah, this weird stuff with kids. Oh.
Mm. There is definitely a movement afoot, and there is a movement afoot in terms of how we are receiving news and how we're continuing to receive news. And I see it with the kids. So I've had an absolute houseful here overnight. It was just so funny. These guys, a couple of the kids came in, and I call them kids, I couldn't, because they're young men. I mean, they're 17 and 18 years old. Two of them came in last night and said to me, hey, Marie, have you got any more RCR lanyards and stickers and keychains? And I haven't got, I'm all tapped out at the minute. I need to get some more. Oh, because we want to go out and represent. We want to go out and represent. And these kids see it. It was really nice. I'm so going to be on the blower today to get some more in. But it is, because they can see it. They understand it. They're not sucked in to essentially the bullshit. And they're young enough and brave enough and open enough that they don't feel that they need to conform to it either. They're not listening and tapped into the traditional media sources. They're like, no, we're going to pave our own path. It's, for me, that's really, really hopeful. Hopeful.
I did one of those 10-day Vipassana meditation retreats once, which it's not something you say, oh, you've got to do it. It's a long 10 days. But when you start meditating, your mind just goes, you know, when you really get into it, and you're doing it for hours at a time, your mind just becomes like a wild animal that's tethered up, and it starts spitting out all this just weird stuff. And eventually there's a part of you that isn't thinking with words necessarily, but is going, well, that's a bit odd. That's not something I believe. And it's like wokeness got to that point. It just got so ridiculous. You can imagine kids would have just detached from the education process and gone, oh, you know, as I said to my daughter, you know, how much do you know about my sexual preferences? Well, nothing. Well, how would you feel if I made my whole identity about my sexual preferences? That would be weird. And how would you feel if I felt the need to communicate those to other people's children? Well, that would be disgusting. Well, that's what's going on at school when they want to tell you this or normalize that. It, you know, maintain that understanding. Yeah, it's a bit weird. having this creepy interest in the sexuality of other people's kids. They've endured this just increasingly shrill series of just ideas that don't bear close scrutiny. And yeah, I mean, it always heartens me when I hear that your kids are in their late teens now, some of the most conservative generation since World War II. I think that's...
Yeah, they're an amazing young bunch of men. And then I read this report this morning before we got started. It's in the Herald on Sunday, What's Wrong With Our Schools? New report paints a bleak picture of our education standards. And it's Derek Cheng. And Derek, he loves himself a good number, does our Derek. It's a conundrum of the heart of the new report, Searching for Utopia, published this week by Sir Peter Gluckman's think tank, COI2, the Centre for Informed Futures. Talk about a report on, for someone like me, as a parent with a kid going through the school system, I think if you read this, you probably had the same feeling. Talk about a report of no shit, Sherlock, overstating the obvious. It does break down the fact that educational standards are dropping significantly. We know that. Erica Stanford knows that. That's why the government are putting their new educational policies in place. But nowhere in here does it actually address the social engineering that has gone on with our education system that I think has been at the heart of all of this. When you start inserting yourself subtly between a parent and a child, which I think our education system has done, and start playing parent, a higher power, as it were, you're going to start creating problems. And they've talked about all the other social issues and all of those things, and they've kind of danced around it, but they won't be reflective. And not once did they say the bullshit policies in place have ducked this up.
Have a listen to Paul's interview with Penny Marie from, I think it was on Monday, but I look it up on the replays. What Let Kids Be Kids are uncovering about the powers over other people's children that the education system has helped themselves to is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've got this framework for psychological wellness or whatever that asks kids these questions, and you catch a, you know, she pointed out, you catch a kid on a bad day, maybe they just had a fight with their parents, you know, they get categorized in the system, and as a parent, you don't necessarily get informed of what's going on. And that should be very, very concerning. And I think nationals should, and the government should be walking that stuff back a lot more rapidly than it is. But national, as I said earlier, it's pretty infested with wokeness itself.
It is. One of the things that stood out, that leapt out from me from this report, was a third of students do not think that going to school every day is important, and 22% think that school is not important for their future.
Mm.
That's terrifying. That many children are completely disengaged with the process and see any value in it. Not once in all of this did it ask why those kids. The only thing it said here is they believed that potentially the parents might have, it says this might be a reflection of the parents. Really? You're going to blame that on the parents, are you? In some cases, yeah, it could be a reflection of the parents. But maybe, could it be potentially a reflection of the value of what they think they're actually achieving by what they're learning at school?
Well, you've got that horrifying statistic where the ability of New Zealand children to read and do mathematics has been steadily trending downwards while NCEA results were steadily trending upwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just in one statistic, you've got a big part of the problem laid bare.
Oh yeah, and Derek has said, national assessment of year 8 students show that 47% are at or below curriculum level for reading, so essentially half, while for maths it's 22%. And while the Program for International Student Association, PISA, shows that 15-year-olds in New Zealand above the OECD average for reading and mathematics and science, there have been significant performance drops. In mathematics, the proportion of students achieving below NCEA level 2, considered by the OECD to be the baseline level of proficiency, increased significantly from 15% in 2003 to 29% in 2002. That's exactly the point that you've just given.
There's no small amount of messaging from the education system that, well, the world's going to boil in 10 years. So maybe kids have absorbed that, and so they don't see, you know, genuinely don't see that it's much use to learn maths. If the world's just going to boil, then there's the messaging that if child is non-Māori, they're here somehow illegally or illegitimately. None of those are terribly empowering ideas for kids. You know, even if they're true, which I don't think they are, but because something's true, if it's disempowering to a child, you've got to question, well, is it ethical to give them that message?
Mm. The article concluded with, there is a growing recognition in some quarters that a one-size-fits-all model of schooling does not adequately or efficiently cater for the diversity of students and student needs, the paper says. It questions whether a traditional classroom system is fit for purpose, given how not every child in the same age group is at the same developmental phase, nor do they progress at the same rate in each subject. The school calendar should also be up for debate, given research suggesting the loss of learning following an extended summer break.
Yeah.
Leaves that open for the charter school option, really, doesn't it? That sort of says that if you want to do it differently, you now have the framework to be able to do that.
Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers is wonderful on that sort of thing, that the key difference between rich kids and poor kids is that during the holidays, rich kids are sent to on a whole lot of programs to learn stuff, and poor kids just try to occupy their time. And as a result, at the end of the holidays, poor kids tend to have lost intelligence and rich kids have gained some. And so that's what drives inequality, not the performance of the school system. And within charter schools, often the variable is more time in school equals better results.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's...
So with your Māori Minister of Education for the Māori Party, Marie here from RCR, the Minister of Education, what would be some of the key things that you would strip out from the current curriculum to make things better?
Oh, boy. Well, a lot of the social engineering, if not all of it, and you want some proficiency and practical education in doing things. And I mean, something that interests me a lot is if you have a mission, and missions are so important to people, and the thing I'm really passionate about is the restoration of fresh water. I think that the climate change has been a huge red herring, and we could absorb unemployment into things like just planting waterways and ensuring that when fresh water hits the ocean, it's cool, it's teeming with life, it's healthy for the ocean. And if in the course of doing that, you can educate kids on ecology, you can train, you know, people who are unemployed in various skills that make them useful and make them work fit, ready for the private sector. You could kill two birds with one stone, or multiple birds. Not that that's a good conservation analogy. And I think that a lot of the problems, you know, kids who have household jobs to do have a much lower suicide rate. They've got a mission. And I think we owe kids a mission. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about this insipid political leadership that doesn't, and not just of the government, Māori leadership, awful. You know, you just have to think, well, I mean, if I were a Māori leader and those were the educational results, I wouldn't be going, me, you know, the education system, do it better. You know, really drive and don't have it so, well, it's in my interest to have a whole lot of dumb, you know, people who performed poorly at education, because then I can say they're trying to take the treaty away from you and take away your rights, and they'll go on a hikoi. We've got so many problems, and I'm just look at Twitter and the news, and it's frustrating that we're not zeroing in on them and working out, well, we've got our common humanity, let's start there, and then we'll get to our differences later. But children deserve a much, much better deal from us.
Mm. And I think it's, as you said before, with the climate thing, there's a lot of red herrings there, a lot of noise, a lot of bread to do. Because there's like Nathan Jury that I spoke to
a few weeks ago.
That I spoke to a few weeks ago. You know, he's successfully had Māori education and programs run specifically for Māori that actually help improve those numbers. St. Joseph's Māori Girls College, they have outperformed and been at the top of tables. That school has been around for decades and decades and decades, run on solid traditional foundations. And the headmistress there is now just retiring after, I think, 50 years at the helm. So that school has proven that you don't need to be part of the kōhanga generation to actually achieve in Māori education. Te Aotearoa College, same thing. So that misnomer too that you often hear from the likes of those from the kōhanga generation, the Takuta Ferrises and the Hanamaipi Clarks. Hey, yeah, it's great for creating little tribalist activists, and you probably, and to be fair, having seen her in the house and her oratory, yeah, you learn some really fantastic skills there. But there's a heavy level of indoctrination, I think, that goes on there now. So, it's, you know, you get a good dollop of indoctrination alongside your education. So how do you sort of separate those two? Yeah, it's about giving kids the direct foundations that they need, the building blocks that they need. And I think critical thinking. We should be teaching classical studies.
Well, victim mentality is so disempowering as well. It really suits a political leader who wants to gain a following by telling, you know, as I said, it's the bait and a trap, the idea that everything bad that happens to you is someone else's fault, even if to some extent some of it's true. But it's terribly, it just strips your agency away. And it doesn't suit Māori, I always think. It doesn't suit you guys just being whining victims. You know, it suits you being striving winners. You know, it's, and I mean, I'm sure those leaders would argue, well, in many ways we are, yeah, in some ways they are, but the identity is, well, I'm, you know, bad things happen to me because bad things happen to my great-great-great-great-grandparents.
Yes.
You know, I think we need to sort of get done with that, I think.
Well, and I think most Māori are done with that. Like they don't buy into that. It's that
very distorting the media, isn't it? It's very
it is.
You know, you get this view of what the average person thinks that really isn't so. Mm.
For that group that are sold into it, well, you've just abrogated your ability for freedom to get free stuff. That's all that is. So, you know, you need to get yourself out of that. Hey, at COVID inquiry, do you want to go there next?
Yeah, I saw it as a bit of a nothing fest, and I'm looking forward to phase two. But it, as you said earlier, it has been really interesting to see the media lovies walk it back. I mean, Ryan Bridges, you know, albeit one of the better Kiwi media lovies, just tying himself in knots, trying to frame COVID as a big overreaction rather than something that the CIA had wargamed, and not wargamed in the sense of let's see how we can contain the spread and boost people's health so they're less susceptible to it. Oh, no. They wargamed it in terms of how do we use media and social media companies to pivot Western democracies into being dictatorships. So, you know, if you read, I mean, one of the lines out of his column, the long-term consequences of policy settings during and in the wake of COVID on issues such as education, productivity, crime, and social cohesion cannot be overstated and aren't even yet fully understood, which is not to say our response was all bad. It was mostly good, especially at the start when we didn't know where we were heading. We stuck together. The report makes this point clear. But like the theory on pilot whales, we were led astray. I think part of the problem here was the fact that as social beings, we struggled to allow for differences of opinion and thought. We shut down ideas and concerns if they didn't fit the health first at all costs narrative. So sort of, it was just all a big mistake. It's like, you know, these people were WEF young global leaders, and they were in lockstep, if not leading, what other leaders who were involved in that organization were doing. And it resulted in a massive transfer of wealth from the taxpayer to massive corporations.
Mm. Yeah. The one that really stuck in my craw was Heather Duplessis-Allen. Talk about it from the Dollar Short and Daylight file. So she, when the report was released, she had Chris Hipkins on a show, and she really went for him. And he played them, oh, you know, hindsight's almost 2020. I think we mentioned that last week. And then she had a good crack at him because she said, well, no, it isn't, because you actually had this information in January and you hung around with a health mandate until September, which is, you know, even if you sort of give them a few extra months, more than 6 months, than what was necessary. Now, I argue they weren't necessary at all. zero mandates. There was no need for mandates. Now, this is something that she said here, and I'm going to call you out on this, Heather. Honestly, it was, again, one of those, where were you when going on in 2021? For 6 months, maybe eight, they were losing the jobs they didn't need to lose. So that's, in terms of the mandates, the point I just made. Don't say they shouldn't have taken the jab. That's their choice. No adult should be forced to take a jab they don't want. I say this as a mum who's just taken a three-nager in for two horrible jabs this week, and I'm pregnancy jabbed up to the eyeballs. I don't have a problem with jabs. I have a problem with compelling adults to take them at the risk of losing their livelihoods. We live in a liberal democracy, not China. Heather, why were you not saying that in 2021? Heather?
Yeah.
Why not? Because you were.
She lost me when someone wrote in about Klaus Schwab and said, "Who's Klaus? Oh, is this one of those conspiracy theories?" It's like, you know.
Look, it's good that you're saying it now, love, but I'm sorry. We know you don't have any problems with the jabs, darling, because you were one of the ones saying, oh, I'm sick and tired of these people hiding us back. You need to go out and get your jabs so everything can get back to normal. You were part of that brigade. You need to wear this. You were part of the problem. You were promulgating this. You were part of the blob, the media propaganda machine that caused all these. For some, losing their jobs would have meant losing their homes, losing contact with family, marriage breakups and mental breakdowns. That's on you just as much as Chris Hipkins, yep. Jacinda Ardern and Ashley Bloomfield. Wear it, Heather. You have to wear it.
Yeah, people crying in doctor's offices saying they didn't want to get the jab, you know. The total suspension of informed consent, the dismantling of relationship between a doctor and patient on the threat of the doctor losing his practicing certificate, all of those things back then were absolutely unacceptable, just on the face of it. And we found out a lot of people just go along to get along. Mm. But now with the hindsight that it wasn't particularly safe and it wasn't particularly effective, and you're still tying yourself in knots trying to justify it. Yeah, I despair sometimes, Marie.
I do. We'll bring on part two because, of course, in the last couple of days, the American House report has just been released, and theirs was vastly more scathing than ours. It's only just landed, so I haven't had a chance to dive into it. And I'm sure that there will be those in independent media spaces in the United States that are going to look at this report and really dig into it, and it'll be much stronger than what we've seen elsewhere. Our report is very politic. It seems to have followed the vibe that has come out from the United Kingdom and Australia. And in this country, there was never, ever, ever going to be any, hey, you and governance didn't do a fantastic job and these are the areas, because you still have one of the key perpetrators sitting there as the leader of the opposition. So it's not going to happen. And then there's all of this, still this whole, oh, but we need to be better prepared for future pandemics. And then they're throwing in these poor farmers that are having to slaughter all these chickens, even though there's no crossover. It's come from wild waterfowl. There's no crossover into human, but there might be in the future. Oh, you know, that little pressure point.
Yeah, the big creepy article in the Sunday Star Times about the need to vaccinate our native birds.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah.
I know, I saw that. And I just, it's like, let it go, people. Just let it go. You need to let this shit go.
We need to go inside the race to save our native taonga from bird flu. They always use taonga in a
weird
way.
I know. Yeah.
Our native birds aren't things that are won at the point of a spear. But, yeah, no, you can sort of feel that ramping up. And as I said, the Woody Allen of New Zealand's public health is grooming away.
He is.
For his stepdaughter. But, yeah, just going back through the Sunday Star Times, there was that coverage of Labor's conference. And there was a quote that jumped out at me that I sent you, which was Barbara Edmonds, who's widely touted as being the future of Labor, saying, as finance minister, I would make choices that support all Kiwis to thrive, she said. Returning to a budget surplus is a moot point if you are not providing Kiwis with health care that they need. This government is governing the country as if they are managers of a company, but that misses the whole point of government. This is the interesting bit, the whole point of government, which is to make sure all people are looked after. It's a very patronising attitude, isn't it? I don't want government looking after me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's assuming that we require looking after.
Yeah, yeah. There was that other article, the coalition government that stole Christmas. So you've got that contrast of Doge, and it's like an article by Harriet Boucher where it's just lamenting the small amounts of money that are getting spent on Christmas parties.
That one, actually, where did I put that? That one totally cracked me up because that's assuming, what, Christmas parties is still a thing?
Yeah. She did wind into some of the, at number one is the Public Service Commission, which this year spent more than double any other department with $4,185.88 on four farewell functions. But, you know, it followed criticism of the Ministry of Pacific People's $40,000 farewell party for its boss in August 2023. So, yeah, they're all about the and 88 cents now, but where were they during those excesses? They were pretty quiet about it, but now.
Yeah, so obviously it just shows you that fiscal prudency has actually enacted. So when she did this entire list from the OIA, I was kind of like, oh, good. Okay, well, that's bugger all. Oh, yeah, that's bugger all. That's bugger all. Actually, that's okay. This is all good. So that means that they have dialed it back. I love that the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, one of the largest ministries with 6,197 full-time staff, there will be no cash set aside for the holiday season. Ooh. That is no reflection of the value of the work that our people have delivered in 2024, but made in recognition of the current fiscal environment, said Richard Griffiths, MB's Deputy Secretary in Corporate Services, Finance and Enablement. God, that's a mouthful, isn't it, Richard? The money dude. It's not the first time IMBY hasn't had a Christmas do. Last year, when it was preparing for potential redundancies ahead of the Public Service Minister Nicola Willis's savings drive, IMBY ditched its budgeted $27 per person Christmas party. It decided not to bring it back this year. Now, I mean, look, Christmas parties are great for helping hospo businesses. I'm fully on board with that, and I don't want to discourage if you're in a business and you're able to actually reward your staff and have a Christmas party and support local hospitality in the process, by all means do it. But I don't know about you, our one here was the business, the day job. We do our own thing. We generally have a nice barbecue and a potluck and get a few bottles round and just have a nice time at home because, you know, things are tough. We can't necessarily always put something together. And if the company isn't going to do something, well, we make our own fun and do it ourselves. We don't have to rely on someone else to celebrate our own fun.
Yeah. I'm not sure on the exact scaling, but I'd guess it's at least 100%. If you think about the energy loss from taking tax off people to where it actually gets spent, you know, that $4,000 on a Christmas party is probably quite, you know, it's quite a lot more than that taken out of the productive economy. And yeah, I hope that the government get better at communicating the need to do that. That's assuming that we're not past the point of no return that's going to necessitate a central bank digital currency. You know, I saw Biden is announcing $1 billion in money to go to build houses in Africa, and just the real rancor that's causing in, say, North Carolina, where people are still living in tents, Maui, where people are given $300 each.
For the fires. Yes. Very quickly, because we can do it, because he hasn't done it for several weeks, is Shane DePoe. He hasn't let us down. We're only going to do this so you can read this out in your best, Helen. Insurance rejig needed to protect homes. So it's in regards to the Auckland and Cyclone Gabrielle floods. The floods and the cyclone each cost $2 million in insured losses and billions more in lost economic output, making 2023's twin disasters, the costliest weather events in Aotearoa's history. But 2023 wasn't a one-off. According to the Insurance Council, we broke a record for extreme weather insurance claims in 22, 21 and 2020. Storms are happening more frequently with greater ferocity. There's more assets for them to damage. That's a key thing. You ready? There's no great mystery why. Do we know what that is, Marty? Warmer atmosphere holds more energy and more water, and that means more violent storms. It's climate change. I mean, the fact that records are broken because the cost to actually replace the stuff is so much more expensive than it's ever been before. So therefore, you are kind of going to be breaking records because the cost of replacement is so much higher. But let's not split that chestnut, Marty. Let's not talk about that
missing NIWA data, which showed that there were far, far more intense and frequent storms in the late 1800s.
Yeah.
Let's ignore the fact that there are only about 1% of the climate-related deaths now than there were a century ago.
So I was sort of reading all of this thinking, oh, hold on a minute here. This is beginning to sound very press releasey from our friends at the Helen Clark Foundation. And then as I scrolled down through the article, do you want to read it out from that paragraph?
We're going to need an insurance system that can handle the calls made upon it and use payouts to direct resources to repairing damage and improving resilience. The Helen Clark Foundation has looked at this issue in depth in its new report, Premiums Under Pressure, How Climate Change is Reshaping Residential Property Insurance and What to Do About It.
There's no party without punch. Yeah, he must have had a busy week, so he needed to reject himself.
More and more waspish, Helen Clark. I mean, she had a big sook about Winston Peters meeting Nigel Farage on his UK tour and not taking the time to talk to our biggest trading partner. Surprising me that Don Brash sort of joined forces with her in being very, very pro-China. But, I guess that speaks to her her Maoist past.
Yes, perhaps. Now, we've also had some fantastic feedback. So thank you for everyone that sends the feedback in. We do really appreciate it. And it gives Marty and I a smile every day. So send it in, so we do appreciate it. So this one is from Kiwi Janie. Spot on, Media Matters, 20th of November with Eminem, New Zealand becoming a safer, saner place with your corridor. Oh, thank you. This is from Beth. What can I say that hasn't been said already? You guys are just brilliant and bounce off each other so beautifully. Loving all of today's impersonations too. My pretties is a total crack up. A clever and most entertaining show, all while delivering important media matters. God bless you all. Oh, thank you, Beth. We do appreciate that. Marie and Marty, you are the best entertainment of my week. I'm glad people are finding us. We finished last week, didn't we, you and I? And we were kind of like, oh, that didn't head where we were expecting to head, because we never do. Just so people know, we only usually, you and I, have a brief little chat about things that we might want to cover. And then 9 times out of 10, we never get there. We end up going off on tangents and doing all sorts of things. Love your opinion, banter and analyses of the mainstream media blurb from the week and the cultural verbal diarrhea that we're currently being fed. Also the positives that you recognise and encourage to help find a way forward. There we go, Marty. We are being positive. It occurs to me that it all comes down to work ethic. No matter the colour of your skin, anyone with a high work ethic has been able to succeed in New Zealand in the past 200 years. Those who rely on handouts have settled in the low socioeconomic group, Māori and non-Māori, and are now certainly disadvantaged in our communities. But it wasn't due to the colonialism. It's the expectation that the state owes them a living, a house, free health and education system. As I said before, I believe all of those things are a privilege and not a right. And if you've got that mindset, that all of those things that we have here are a privilege and not a right, you will actually excel beyond that. I really do believe that.
I think you've also got to factor in Matt Taibbi's quote, one of my favourite, where he likened Goldman Sachs to a giant vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity and jabbing its blood funnel in anything that smells like money. I think, it's interesting to see the predatory, parasitic nature of the Federal Reserve banking system coming into US political discourse now, where it's been just a topic that's verboten for so long. And I think, you know, you can always take it back to that astonishing fact that despite manufacturing being far less efficient and consumer goods being so much more expensive, a man used to be able to, in the 50s or 60s, go out to work digging ditches and support a wife at home, four kids, and go to the pub four times a week and get drunk and own his house and own a car. So, you know, there's been a fair bit of siphoning of resource out of the system as well.
And yeah.
You can't just point the finger at people for not working hard enough, I don't think.
And a lot of the siphoning, I think, has come from the blob too. The challenge now is how to give these families the support and assistance need and to lift them out of living standards of that group, keep up the great works. And I think a lot of that is an education system that is fit for purpose and is not filling them with victimhood and identity mumbo jumbo. Oh, I promised myself I promised myself not to get ranty, and here I am getting ranty. You lost me at Heather Duplessis Allen. Anyway, team, great show, my new favourite. Supporters like me maybe should not rock your boat, but there it is. I simply cannot tolerate people control. I too would be in a concentration camp or a ditch with a lime being sprinkled on my corpse if extremists gain control. I place the Dern, the Greens, really the Reds, and the Māori Party and their supporters, those people that reported on their neighbours during COVID, in this category. That scenario is more of a possibility than ever in my lifetime. It has dawned on me recently by listening and observing, chilling as it may be, that violence is an all too real possibility. With my wife, kids, son-in-law and grandson, all of Māori descent, the push towards insurrection by extremists, both Māori and Marxist, is frankly grotesque. And that's from Tracy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's very, very well, point very well made, Tracy.
Yeah, thank you, Tracy. Hey, Marie and Marty, very profound clarity with your delivery. Media matters is essential listening.
Irony.
Big thanks, Roddy. I'm going to leave that in. Hi, guys. The problem I see is we're all in a desperate group. If we had a way to physically or virtually come together to send our message, we'd feel at least we had a chance. Fiona. Well, Fiona, I think we did do that. I think we did that with the occupation and the protests that we had. And I think we do that too. Don't forget, you know, VFF is one of the greatest grassroots movements that has been created in this country in many decades. And that actually, if you're feeling that you need to have a way to physically get together, go and check out, yeah.
Did you say desperate or disparate?
Disparate.
Yeah. Like you said, Desperate.
Or did it sound like desperate? I'm sorry. Disparate. Disparate. She spelled it correctly, disparate. Yeah. Great show, Marie and Marty. So much info today. I'll need a replay. Very good.
But yeah, last week, I'm not talking down. Talking down this week's show, I may sound a bit burned out from being sick and painting, but yeah, last week's show was a cracker. I listened to that one a couple of times.
Yeah, no, it was very, very good. And as always, we thoroughly enjoy it. So thank you, everybody that has sent in feedback. 2057 is the text. inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. We will be back again next week. We've got a couple of more shows up our sleeve before the end of the year, and you and I will go on the great summer detox, and I can't wait. I don't want to see a newspaper. I may even uninstall the Herald app, so I can't be tempted.
I'm looking forward to that as well, Marie. It'll be nice to disconnect from that very negative way of seeing the world.
Mm. Well, I'm going to let you go out now and do something very positive. Continue painting your house, my friend, and thank you everyone for joining us today. And remember, if you want to hear any of our Media Matters replays, you just need to pop over to, I think they've got it on the Counterculture page, or they may have even given us their own page now. Go and pop over and have a look, and we'll just put Media Matters in the search and we'll come up. And if you didn't hear last week's show, it was a cracker. Do check it out. Hey, thanks, buddy, and we'll do it all again next week.
Look forward to it, Marie. Thank you so much for all you do, and have a great week, everyone.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.